All right, thank you. So the first thing I have to do is change my title because I realized there wasn't going to be time to talk about both plagioclase and olivine, and I wasn't sure what the best way to go about doing this was, so I used all of my extensive skills with PowerPoint to just change the title. So hopefully no one will notice, but today we're just going to concentrate on plagioclase and we'll leave olivine for another day. So there's three principal goals of this talk today. First, I want to go over a little bit and discuss the nature of lunar samples, although Randy just did a pretty good job of that, so I can probably skim over that, because in order to understand why we want to know the provenance of the constituent parts of these meteorites, we need to know a little bit more about how they're put together. Next, I'm going to spend a fair amount of time trying to convince you that you can use the electron microprobe to determine trace element concentrations of elements down to a few hundreds of ppm with high levels of precision and accuracy on the orders of tens of ppm. And again, we're specifically going to concentrate on strontium concentrations in plagioclase. And finally, I will actually show you some data that we've just recently taken on strontium concentrations in lunar plagioclase from a variety of lithologies, and we'll look at any systematic differences we see in the strontium concentrations of the different plagioclase from different lunar lithologies. So, a sample overview. This is a backscatter electron image mosaic of lunar meteorite PCA 02007. This is a regolith breccia from the feldspathic highlands of the moon. If you think I'm showing this because it's 44 images I stitched together and I wanted to show off, you're right, but it also illustrates my point that if you look here in the regolith breccia portion, you'll see a diverse clast load. So a polymict breccia is a breccia made up of rocks, of many different types of rocks. So regolith is just fused soil, and if we're able to pull apart this regolith, we're able to determine what the different lithologies both that made up this soil, that made up this regolith, we can learn something about the local geology that this sample came from. So I already said that most lunar samples are polymict breccias. It can be difficult to determine the lithologies that comprise a polymict breccia. If you've got nice lithic clasts, it's pretty easy. So if you've got clasts like this, this is a gabbro clast in MET01210. All right, we know that's a gabbro. That's not hard. But what you often end up with is a lot of individual mineral clasts. It's very difficult at first glance to figure out, oh, AN95 plag, great. Where did that come from? What type of rock did it come from? So that's sort of the whole point of the study, is to try to take individual mineral grains like this plag clast, or here's a nice pyroxene clast, and try to figure out, is it a broken up piece of this? Did it come from a basalt? Is it part of ferronorthosite? And so we're looking for a way to try to see through this. So all these images are too dark. But why do we care about the provenance of a different class within a lunar meteorite? The main reason is because, well, lunar meteorites are an important new suite of samples. We don't know where they came from, and therefore we don't have any geologic context. We didn't have anyone pick them up and take nice pictures of the area. So the best we can do is to look at the different types of clasts that are within a breccia and try to reconstruct, at least partially, the local geology they came from. These are images, backscatter electron images, of the regolith breccia portion of SAU-169 from Oman. And you can see that there's a nice basalt clast in it. There's a, that's a granophere, so it also has some symplectite in there. Here's an impact melt breccia. I can't see well enough. There's actually a little granulite in there, too. So that can give us an idea of what type of rocks were present in the regolith and presumably in the local geology where the sample came from. This is just bookkeeping. I was told, or at least I heard, Jeff Taylor said that if you don't show a thin section image, you get in trouble. So here's my thin section image, but it actually works to illustrate my point. This is a large thin section, centimeter and a half across, of Northwest Africa 3333. This is a complex breccia from Northwest Africa. That is actually it's a regolith or fragmental breccia, depends on who you ask, and it has major lithic class of basalt, of cumulate in it. So we know that there's basalt and cumulate, and then there is feldspar, there is plagioclase within the breccia, and does that feldspar come from the cumulate? Does it come from the breccia? That's something from the basalt. That's something we'd like to be able to figure out eventually. And no, I won't give you the answer today. So on to the technical part. I maintain that by optimizing analytical conditions, you can achieve an analytical precision of about 20 ppm by electron probe microanalysis. And when I say optimizing analytical conditions, I mean you jack the probe current way up, you count for a long time, and you're really careful about where you choose your background positions. Now, there are any number of minerals whose trace element systematics could tell us something about where those minerals came from, and I've listed them here, but I just want to concentrate on strontium and feldspar today. So just to pimp our probe a little bit, this is our new probe at WashU. It's a Joule 8200 super probe. We got 5 spectrometers, SDD, EDS detector, CL detector. We also use Probe for Windows automation software, and the reason I mention that is because that allows us to do two things that the Joule software does not. We can integrate elements determined simultaneously on multiple spectrometers. I want to count for 720 seconds. I can do that 4 spectrometers at 180 seconds and do the analysis in 6 minutes, not 24 minutes. It also allows for quantitative correction for peak interferences, and you'll see that for strontium that's a particular problem and something that really needs to be addressed. And our probe tech would like me to point out that no matter what else you notice in the probe, ignore this, that just that we have these huge monitors, and he's very proud of those. So this is more detailed than most of you want. I thought the people who were interested could, you know, look at the bottom part while I'm blathering on about the top part, but the nominal measurement conditions we used were 15 keV accelerating voltage, a 200 nanoamp beam current, and typically a 40 micron beam diameter. We count a strontium 180 seconds on 4 different spectrometers. We do long background counts, and where you do your background counts is important. Now, people are probably looking at 200 nanoamps and plagioclase, and oh my God, you're killing the sodium in there. But it turns out that at 40 micron beam, you don't. And we actually have a way to volatile correct for sodium and silica, although it's not really needed. And if we go down to smaller beam diameters, say down to 10 microns, then it does become a problem a little bit. We see 1 or 2% sodium volatilization, but we're able to correct for that using standards. And then the spectrometer stuff is not really that important. So when I said there was a peak interference, here's your peak interference. I wanted to be the first one to show a squiggly line diagram in here, but I guess I ruined that by filling it in, so it's not really going to look like the ones later. But what we're looking at here is a portion of the spectrum from one of our spectrometers in the region of strontium. So this is on a National Bureau of Standards 500 ppm glass. That means there's 500 ppm of strontium, which is this little peak, and about 50 weight percent silica, which is comparable to what you see in plagioclase. And you can see the strontium lies right in between the silica K alpha and the silica K beta. It's on an artificially high background, and it's directly interfered on by the silicon satellite K beta peak. So Probe for Windows basically can subtract off the proportion of this peak that is due to interference from that peak. And that ends up being a correction of about 80 ppm in a lunar plagioclase. So it's an important correction, and I think we're doing it pretty well. Just to show you how good our data is, or how good I think our data is, there's a lot on here, but what I did were 12 replicate analyses on a series of standards that contain strontium. So the individual points are the individual analyses with 2 sigma counting errors, error bars on there. The solid red line represents the average composition of the 12 points. The solid blue line is the book value for the standard, and then the red lines are just one standard deviation around the unknown value, just to give you an idea of the spread. And for high concentrations of strontium in the thousands or many hundreds of ppm, we do pretty well. We are able to get within 10 to 20 ppm in absolute concentration and a relative difference of between of less than 2 or 3%. If we lower this down and look at something with about 350 to 400 ppm strontium, we're still able to do pretty well. We only have about a 7 ppm difference between what we measure and what the book value is. And the reason I'm only showing this is we sort of lack good standards for strontium at low concentrations. And there just aren't that many standards with well-defined strontium concentrations that low. So this is sort of the lowest one we have, so that's what we're living with. If we don't have any strontium in there, how are we doing? Because we're making a major silica correction, and if we're doing that wrong, all these numbers are wrong. So if we analyze quartz, which has no strontium in it, and we should get 0, we end up getting about 15 ppm. So we're doing pretty good. I can't put a percent on that, but we're only off by about 15 ppm. And I have other standards that have no strontium in them and silica, and it goes from about negative 12 ppm to 15 ppm, and that's our range. So perhaps the silica correction could be further refined, but I'm not sure we're going to be able to do much better than that. And if we look at something like synthetic titanium, which has no strontium and no silica, you see that we actually can get a lot closer to zero without taking any heroic efforts here. All right, so after all that, now I'll actually show some data. So here you have strontium versus sodium concentrations for individual plagioclase analyses in a broad variety of lunar lithologies. And I'll break these down a little bit. There's a lot of data on here, and you can't really see anything specific here. But mostly I want you to see that you see a relatively large dynamic range of strontium from about 80 to 100 ppm, which is about our detection limit, up to about 800. And you see, I've plotted all the... I plotted all the fan rocks here in green. The magnesium suite is in yellow. The creepy samples are in red. And then the various alkali suite minerals are in purple lithologies. And then the blue is... thanks, Brad. That's what you have co-workers for. Aha. And then the blue are the basalts. So let's look in a little bit more detail. Let's zoom in down here near the origin. And now we're looking at a bunch of different Farrawinna northite suite rocks here, the magnesium suite, and then you have this one, Northwest Africa 3333 cumulate. This isn't a surprise. We knew something about the strontium concentrations from INEA and other bulk chemical techniques, and we knew that these were going to be low concentrations, but we do seem to be able to measure it well because these match well with our INEA data. We have a wide range of fan suite rocks here from anorthosite down to norite, and we don't see any kind of systematic difference in the concentration based on the mafic-ness of the sample. And again, these are two sigma counting errors. We need more magnesium sweet rocks. We only have the one. So for right now, it seems that magnesium sweet rocks have lower concentrations of strontium in plagioclase than fan, but with a data set of one, that's probably stretching it a little bit. So, right, so if we move on to the creepy samples here, we've got a bunch of different creepy samples. We have the impact melt from SAU169, Apollo 12 high thorium impact melt breccias, and creep basalt. We see that they all have much higher concentrations, in a Apollo 14 ultra creepy sample. And we see that these all plot at higher concentrations of strontium than the fan or the magnesium sweet samples. We also see that... that they are positively correlated with sodium, and I mean, I just drew these in to draw your eye to it, but not all creepy samples have the same concentrations. They don't all seem to have the same strontium to sodium ratio, so there may be more to do in, or there is more to do in here, but there may be more data, more information that we can pull out. And it also looks like not all AN95 plage is created equal. So, I mean, there are usually class of anorthite in even the creepiest of samples, and if we look at the amount of strontium that is in those AN95 plage, it is quite different than what you see in typical ferronorsite sweet rocks. So that's worth noting. And also, if you're going to work with terrestrial hot desert lunar meteorites, you have to be careful of all the strontium that's in the cracks, which I think is what happened there. So just a word of warning. I'm running out of time, so just real briefly, here are a bunch of different basalts from a couple lunar meteorites, some Apollo 12 basalts. And the main point here is that the plage with the highest concentrations of strontium actually was a basalt and not a creepy sample. We also, the slope, the strontium to sodium ratio in plage is much shallower than it is in creepy samples. The creepy samples were like this. So strontium concentrations increase much more quickly relative to sodium. I'm not going to have time to go through all the alkali sweet samples, but we have the data here. Granite plots off by itself, so does Monzo Gabbro, alkali anorthosites in here. It looks like they overlap entirely with creep, and they do. I've sort of blotted out or whited out the creep samples here, but these were all very creepy samples, 2 to 3 times high K creep. So if I was to plot, I should have picked some more typical creep samples. That would have been a better comparison. And I won't read my summary because I'm sort of out of time and I'd like to get at least one question. So please read this, and thank you very much for your time.
All right, we have time for some questions from the floor.
Looking at